Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. At Beth Emmanuel, we teach Messianic Judaism for all nations. If you find these teachings helpful, please share them with your friends and family. Help us advance the teachings of the kingdom, and remember to support Beth Emmanuel with your prayers and financial gifts.
So today we're going to do something much more academic. We are going to learn the seven laws of Noah. How long could that take? 7 minutes, maybe? We'll see. I have a lot of material here. Anyway, so here's the situation. If you want to open up your Bible, we'll just kind of get rooted in the scriptures in Genesis chapter 9. And God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. The fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth, and upon every bird of the heavens, upon everything that creeps on the ground, and all the fish of the sea. Into your hand they are delivered. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you, and as I gave you the green plants, I give you everything. But you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is its blood. And for your lifeblood, I will require a reckoning. From every beast, I will require it, and from man. From his fellow man, I will require a reckoning for the life of man. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For God made man in his own image. And you, be fruitful and multiply. Teem on the earth and multiply in it." And then God said to Noah and to his sons with him, "Behold, I establish my covenant with you and with your offspring." A covenant is a formal declaration of commitments that define a relationship between two parties. So in the ancient Near East, you made covenants. You know, covenants is like you typically required an altar, an animal sacrifice. All these things are going on here in this passage about Noah. Every covenant entails terms and conditions incumbent on both parties. And for his part, we see the Lord he's bound himself by certain covenant terms and conditions. For his part, he'll never flood the earth again with water. Didn't say anything about meteors or anything like that. But he said, "I won't use water." Noah and his sons had to commit to maintaining certain standards of ethical conduct as well. And Jewish tradition explains the terms of God's covenant with Noah as consisting of universal standards that apply to all human beings, all the sons of Noah, that is, all human beings. And these are called the Noahide laws. And the sages taught that these commandments of the Torah apply universally. If not, follow the logic here. If there wasn't such a standard, a universal standard, how could God punish anyone for anything? How could God have even punished the people in the story of Noah if he didn't ever give them any standard, any code of conduct? Why did he punish the people of Sodom and Gomorrah? If you know, you can't just like I don't think it's like he's just like, "Oh, you know, you people, that's just so irritating to me." And then he wipes them out. No, there has to be a clear code of conduct. As Paul says, sin is not imputed when there is no Torah. Words of Paul. So why did he drive out the Amorites and the Canaanites, you know, in the days of Joshua? How could he judge the nations if there's not a standard of righteousness by which to make judgment? And so the sages said, well, it must be here. We must see it here in Noah. And so if you do a careful literal reading of the passage we were just looking at, Genesis 9, 1 through 6, you'll come up with four laws: be fruitful and multiply, which we're not sure if that's a mitzvah or a blessing. Don't eat meat with the lifeblood still in it, be number two. And number three, don't murder, right? And number four, put murderers to death. That's about as good as I can do out of that passage. But the rabbis read between the lines of the passage and they made several logical inferences to derive a total of seven general laws that they believe to be incumbent on all humanity. First, they assumed monotheism as self-evident. After all, God's talking to Noah. You know, so that should be self-evident. So they wrote in two laws pertaining to belief in God, which are prohibitions on idolatry and blasphemy, which are things that we see the nations being punished for. And second, the rabbis understood, be fruitful and multiply, perhaps as the antithesis to sexual immorality, which tends to have the opposite effect. And also, there's the issue with that the earth had corrupted its way. The earth had corrupted its way, which implies sexual immorality, as in the case of the Nephilim and the fallen angels and the daughters of men and that whole story. Third, the rabbis noted that the earth had been punished for the sin of robbery. That was one of the moral deficiencies which brought the flood. So they added theft to the list, and then finally they saw that the requirement for man to spill the blood of a murderer could be misunderstood as an endorsement of vigilante-style justice. So they steered away from that interpretation, and they steered towards a civil form of jurisprudence by mandating the establishment of courts of law. It makes sense. It's logical. And voila, you got seven. Number one, don't worship idols or other gods. Number two, don't blaspheme God's name. Number three, don't murder. Number four, don't commit sexual immorality. Number five, don't steal. Number six, don't eat things while they're still alive. And number seven, establish courts of justice. Pretty simple. Let's go have lunch. Well, you know, actually there's more to it than that. These seven laws are—they work more as categories than specific rules. They're like broad categories, and they include several laws, several other laws. And so I guess you could say they form a sort of minimalistic approach to ethical monotheism. You know, believe in God, be a decent person, be kind to animals, settle your disputes in court, but it's much broader than that. So here's what I want to do. This is what we're going to do today. I mean, and, you know, the seven laws are sort of disappointing if you're a one-law sort of messianic Gentile, you know, and you're, like, all jazzed out with, like, hey, I'm totally got my, you know, stuff on. You know what I'm talking about? It's like, whoa, seven laws? What? Wait, I had 613 a minute ago. Now I'm down to seven laws. I mean, some people would say, well, that's a bonus, you know. I had that conversation once with a Lubavitcher said to me, so when are you ever going to, you know, convert? He said it in different language. He used some crude idioms. But so when are you ever going to convert? I said, you know, I'm having trouble with the laws that do apply to me already. He said, I don't know what you mean by that, but I'm sure you know what you mean by that. Anyway, seven laws. Doesn't sound too bad. Could get by with this. But let's be clear. There's more to it than that. I'm going to try and put this into terms that it'll make sense to you. And you know Acts 15, our apostles add four laws. They're not the same as the seven. They're seven plus four. Okay, so now we're up to 11. 11 laws. Okay. 11 laws, but there's more to it than that. I mean, the thing is that in the days of the apostles, these seven laws were already on the books. Judaism already had this going, and it explains a lot, because some people look at the four laws and say, what? Why isn't this there, and why isn't that there? And, well, that's over in the seven laws. It explains a lot. But some people say, well, you know, I don't think those laws went back to the first century. Forget that. They're back in the first century. They're in the Book of Jubilees. So if you were an idolater living in the days of the apostles, and you met the Apostle Thomas, you know, the Apostle Thomas, or maybe it was Thaddeus. It could have been Thaddeus, or it could have been the Apostle Mari. Did you know there's an apostle named Mari? There is an apostle named Mari. He was a very famous apostle. It's not in the Bible, but people remember him. And they called him Mar Mari, which meant Mr. Mari. But that was his name, Mar Mari. So let's go with Mar Mari, okay? So you meet Mar Mari. You're living up there in Armenia, where Mar Mari's working. And he tells you about Jesus. And you and the one God, and so on. And so you confess your sins, and you give your life to Jesus and accept him in your heart as your personal Savior. And what next? What does the Lord, the God of Israel, require of you? How much of the Torah, the law, applies to you? What are the rules of this new religion? So the first thing that Mar Mari would do is say, Let me tell you about Noah. I'll open you up to learn about the laws of Noah. Here's the thing you need to know. These laws of Noah are more like categories. So we're going to run through and see what things fit under each category. That's the goal. So we'll start with idolatry. Number one, idolatry. The prohibition on idolatry includes, and this applies to everyone, you realize, this applies to all human beings, Jews, Gentiles, believers, not believers, all of them. The prohibition on idolatry includes a prohibition on making or honoring any physical representation of a god or of God, the Lord, and a prohibition on worshiping and sacrificing or praying to any god other than the Lord. It includes the prohibition on worshiping any created thing, any created being, whether a heavenly body, whether an angel, an animal, a natural phenomenon, trees, which is popular again, human beings, Nimrod, you can't worship people, Caesar is out, which was a problem in the first century, big problem that you couldn't worship Caesar, that a lot of people lost their lives because of that one. So it prohibits the creation of any object for purposes of veneration and worship. The prohibition on idolatry forbids us from bowing to an idol or showing it any form of service or acknowledging that an idolatrous religion is true. Even if the idol is not present, it is forbidden to honor it. For example, pouring out a libation to a god. It's sort of a party trick. It's like, hey, let's pour out a libation to Dionysus or something. A long time ago it was. But this is forbidden. This is forbidden. The prohibition on idolatry forbids persuading others to practice idolatry. And according to Jewish tradition, it also includes the prohibitions on the occult arts. Spell casting, charms, spirit channeling, fortune telling, communing with the dead, sorcery, divination, other magical rituals. In summary, the Torah's numerous laws that deal with idolatry and the occult pertain then to everyone, to Gentiles. That's a lot. That's a big chunk of the Bible's laws right there. That's more than seven. You got more than seven already. Okay, number two, blasphemy. How's blasphemy work? And where do we get blasphemy anyway? How do you derive blasphemy? I found out where the blasphemy comes from, the blasphemy prohibition. It's from Job. Because Job, Job's not a Jew. Job is a Gentile. That's what he's sitting there, and his wife says to him, just curse God and die, right? And he says, you speak as a foolish woman speaks. Shall we accept good from the Lord and not evil? And then the book of Job says, in all of this, Job did not sin with his lips. Well, here's a Gentile. So obviously, if he had cursed God, that would be sinning with his lips. Therefore, this must be a law that pertains to non-Jewish people, that they should not curse God. So there's a prohibition on blasphemy. And in this, we have Jewish tradition prescribes a blessing for us, even for hearing bad news. This is a good one you should know. God forbid that you need to ever use it. But just in case you did, here's the blessing for hearing bad news. Blessed be the true judge. That's it. You don't even say God's name. Just blessed be the true judge. Baruch Dayan Emet. Because you don't want to blaspheme. The prohibition on blasphemy includes all the Torah's laws about sanctifying God's name. For example, this law includes the prohibition on making a false oath, swearing falsely in his name, in the name of the Lord, or taking the Lord's name in vain, desecrating the name of God, etc., etc. A lot of laws. Point is, a lot of laws fall under this category. Okay, number three, murder. This one seems obvious. Murder is off the books. You can't be murdering people. There is a difference between murder and killing, by the way, in Hebrew. It's a different word. So in Jewish law, the prohibition includes the murder of the unborn. It includes euthanasia. One who is able to prevent the death of another and does not do so transgresses the prohibition against murder. The law against murder also includes a prohibition on suicide. It includes all the Torah's laws of manslaughter. The Torah's laws of cities of refuge, of fleeing to a city of refuge, and that sort of thing. All of these are included under the category of murder. By extension, the laws of murder, and this is a rabbinic extension, the laws of murder include the prohibitions on gossip, evil speech, and character assassination, which the Torah equates with murder. As it says, you shall not go about slandering among your people. You are not to act against the life of your neighbor. Leviticus 19:16, where it says, so the implication of Leviticus 19:16 is that if you speak evil about a person, you're acting against his life, and that is a step towards murder, so it's forbidden. All right, so that's a lot of laws right there. I mean, that's more than seven right there. That's a ton. That's a ton of the Torah's laws. All right, fornication, zina, sexual immorality. This prohibition applies universally to all human beings, but it's a little iffy. This one's a little troublesome. Jewish law interprets the prohibition, you know, to forbid relations in terms of, like, if you're Jewish, this is very narrow. It's a very narrow category. It's defined in Leviticus 18, what is, you know, forbidden relationships and so on and so forth. And the rabbis derived a principle from Genesis 2:24, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife and be one flesh, which Rashi explains that the Holy Spirit is here indicating that this forbids forbidden relationships of any type. But the problem is, back in the first century, there was a discussion about this because, you know, we're dealing with Romans. So the question is, all right, now we're dealing with these Romans, and, you know, we've seen the movies with the Romans. It's like, woo, right? And so what do you do with Romans? I mean, what's sexual immorality to a Jew is different than what sexual immorality to a Roman? And so the sages deliberating on this, and this is in the Tosefta, they said, well, we'll go by whatever the standard of that nation is. So, because every nation has a line, you have a line, say, okay, you can't cross that line. We even in this country, there's a line. You know, there are certain things that are illegal still. And so there's these lines, and you can't cross these lines within your own country. And so the Jewish people said, they said, we'll just let each country, you know, each people group, each nation decide that for themselves. We know what our deal is. Our deal is defined strictly by the scriptures. All right, but everybody else, so this didn't work for the apostles so much when we were bringing in Gentiles into the church. This did not work for the apostles, and that's why they had to specify in Acts 15. They had to specify. The apostles clarified the ambiguity for Gentile disciples of Yeshua by holding them to the same biblical standard of permitted and forbidden relationships as expressed in the law, and they forbade all sexual immorality, not according to a cultural definition, but according to a biblical definition of forbidden unions, forbidding all sexual contact outside of wedlock, where wedlock is defined as legally sanctioned monogamous heterosexual relationships. And they held the disciples these Gentiles to this rule from Rabbi Yeshua of one man, one woman, which is derived, like Rashi did, from Genesis 2:24. A man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall be one. Our master says, this is how it was from Bereshit, from the beginning. Okay. Number five, theft. The prohibition on theft applies universally to all human beings. Not only does this apply to theft of personal property, also this prohibits kidnapping, all forms of financial malfeasance, swindling, extortion, dishonesty for the sake of taking advantage of another, prohibits overcharging, using unjust weights and measures, moving boundary stones, encroaching on another person's livelihood, all forms of dishonest or abusive business transactions. The law against theft prohibits withholding the salary of a worker. It includes the prohibition on rape and seduction, which involve theft for the sake of gratification. Cannibalism actually falls under this category. I thought that was interesting. Yeah, I guess. Some authorities include the prohibition on assault under the prohibition of theft. Others include the prohibition on coveting. So in summary, the prohibition on theft includes all the Torah's laws which prohibit taking advantage of somebody else. Somebody else and their stuff. Hands off. Okay, that's the first five. And I'll give you a quick timeout, sort of like an intermission. That's the first five. What did we have? Idolatry, blasphemy, murder, fornication, theft. This is all summarized in the Didache. Apostolic era writers summarize these first five laws. They said, Didache 2:2 says, you shall not commit murder, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not commit pedophilia, you shall not commit fornication, you shall not steal, you shall not practice magic, you shall not practice witchcraft, you shall not murder a child by abortion, nor kill that which is begotten. This pretty much sums up that whole thus far. Okay, we have just two to go. Number six. And this is the really the difficult one, is the limb of a living animal. And see, the Lord commanded Moses, or Noah, saying, every moving thing that's alive shall be food for you. I give to you, just like I give you the plants, I give you everything, only, he says, you shall not eat flesh with its life, its blood. And on the surface, this law sounds similar to several other laws, but there's a verse in Deuteronomy that confuses the issue. In Deuteronomy 14, 21, it says, you shall not eat anything which dies by itself. You may give it to the alien who is in your town, that would be the non-Jewish person, so that he may eat it. You may sell it to a foreigner, but you, being the Jewish people, are a holy people to the Lord your God, and you shall not eat it. So, we have a conflict. If the law to Noah is to be interpreted that you cannot eat something that dies by itself because its blood is still in it, then how does Deuteronomy 14:21 work with that? And so the sages looked at this very carefully and said, you know, the wording is different. It is a little different than the other instances that prohibit blood. And he came up with this. They said, you know what's going on here? In Genesis 9, we're talking not just about ingesting blood, which is not so much the issue in Genesis 9. Rather, we're talking about eating the meat or flesh of a living animal while its blood, its lifeblood, its soul actually is still in it. So it's still alive. So this is interpreted, it's understood as a prohibition on eating a living creature. What that, you know, I had a Lubavitch rabbi explain it to me like this. He said, look, sometimes what you would do in the ancient world is because you couldn't eat the whole animal all at once, you would just, you know, eat it a little bit at a time, you know, and then it's forbidden. It's forbidden to eat an animal that's still alive. Okay. This explains why the apostles had to add the prohibition on the prohibitions, the dietary prohibitions in Acts 15. Number seven, courts of justice. Oh, I was going to say, you know, that number six, then there's extensions on that. That's the literal commandment. Don't eat the animal while it's still alive. The extensions have to do with ethical treatment of animals. You know, don't be cruel to animals. Number seven, courts of justice. The commandment is inferred from the statement, whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. And this implies existence of courts of law. So I want you to think about this. How many of the laws in the Bible pertain to courts of law? In, for example, Parshat Mishpatim, which is called judgments. I think there's like 60 laws in there that pertain to courts of judgment in one form or another. Or in Parshat Shoftim, which means judges. There's all sorts of, we find tons of Torah law, of biblical law, that have to do with jurisprudence, how to conduct trials. Case precedent is a lot of case precedent in the Bible. Say, you know, if your ox, this ox, you know, falls in a pit and gores, your neighbor's, you know, on and on. Those are case precedents. All of these laws, all of the Torah's laws of justice, legal procedure, litigation, tort law, fines, penalties, all of these rules are included in the category to establish courts of justice. So these are the laws that are binding on all human beings. It's absolutely wrong then to say that the Torah does not apply to Gentiles, because that's a sizable amount of Torah. A lot more than seven simple rules. It's a huge amount of the commandments. And of course, the apostles regarded the Gentile believers, the Christians, in a totally different category. So far, we've just been talking about a person who isn't even a believer in Jesus. You know, just this is just the average person, the amount of Torah that applies to the average Filipino. I don't know why I picked out the Filipinos. My mind sped around the globe, and I landed in a random place, and I plucked up a random people group. Happen to be the Philippines. Anyway, should this Filipino be a believer in Jesus, he enters another category. He's no longer considered merely a son of Noah, but he enters the category that Paul calls the son of Abraham by faith. The son of Abraham. Because he is a servant of the king of the Jews. And the apostles refer to him then, they put him in the category of a stranger in our midst. A stranger dwelling in the midst of Israel. It's an actual legal category in the Torah. And there's laws for strangers dwelling in the midst of Israel in Leviticus 17 and 18. And I've taught on this before. I've taught on this recently. But it's from Leviticus 17 and 18 where we derive the four laws that the apostles added for Gentiles. In addition to these seven, they said, abstain from things sacrificed to idols. So it's not only don't worship idols, now you can't even eat the food that's been contaminated by idolatry. Abstain from blood. So now it's not only don't eat the limb of a living animal, now don't even eat the don't eat blood. Even if the animal's dead, don't eat its blood. And the reason is not because it's gross, although it is, but because it's one of the laws in Leviticus 17. For strangers in the midst of Israel. And they said, don't eat things strangled, which is one of the laws in Leviticus 17 for strangers in the midst of Israel. And that's, something unslaughtered, meat that hasn't been ritually slaughtered. And they said, and from fornication, which we've already discussed. We've already been over that material. Each of these four laws then function as a general category, which includes a lot of laws, which I won't go over right now. But when we combine all of these seven, the seven and their various derivations with the four laws of the apostolic decree and all their implications, we discover that we ended up with a lot of the 613, particularly prohibitions, it seems like all the negative commandments, thank you very little, apply to the Gentile believers and are incumbent on them, When do we get some positive, I need some positive commandments, some thou shalt. I mean, this is all like downer stuff, like thou shalt not do this, thou shalt not do that. It's a list of no. And get some positive stuff going. And so if you want the positive stuff, the apostles also said this. They said, we have a whole nother category that we're going to hold you to, Mari says to the guy up in Armenia, or we tell our Filipino who's become a believer. There's a whole nother category of laws in the Bible that apply to you. And this is based on the mitzvah in Leviticus 19:18 that says, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Now, originally, the Jewish people, they understood this commandment to mean, you shall love your fellow Jew as yourself. But then our master, Yeshua, came along and he said, you know what? I'm going to broaden that definition. I think it means, you shall love your fellow human being as yourself. And he told the story of the Good Samaritan to illustrate his point. And based on this broadening of what neighbor means, all of a sudden, all of the commandments that pertain to you shall love your neighbor as yourself are binding upon us as disciples of Yeshua. And so when Yeshua says, in everything, therefore, treat people the same way they want you to treat you, for this is the Torah, the apostles used that teaching as the basis for requiring God-fearing Gentile believers, the Gentile Christians, to adhere to the Torah's commandments governing social interaction and human relationships. We see this in Galatians 5:14, where Paul lists it and he says, the Torah is fulfilled in one statement, in one word, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Or he says it in Romans 13 as well. He says, he who loves his neighbor has fulfilled the Torah. So these other commandments, you shall not commit adultery, murder, steal, covet, you know, all the commandments can be summed up in, you shall love your neighbor as yourself, Paul says. Love does no wrong to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of the Torah. That's not to dismiss the other commandments. It's a category. It's a category. The love your neighbor category finds expression in dozens and dozens of apostolic statements that have the words one another in them. Anytime you're reading in the epistles and you find the words one another, you know, be kind-hearted towards one another, endure one another, love one another, care for one another, consider others more worthy than you, however it's worded, however it's put. You know what I'm talking about. A lot of the epistles have that one another, and your brother language. These are all derived from you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And so all of the laws of the Torah that fall into that category governing interpersonal relationships with one another, all of these things also are incumbent upon Gentile believers. I mean, so these are my thoughts on Parshat Noach. And let me just sum up with a few simple points here and we'll be done. Number one, just a little review. The sons of Noah are obligated to keep seven laws. They're not just simple rules. They are broad categories that include a significant amount of the Torah. Number two, Gentile believers are more than just sons of Noah. It's not just sons of Noah plus Jesus. Our allegiance to Messiah puts us in a different category called sons of Abraham by faith, and halakhically speaking, the stranger who sojourns among Israel. Therefore, the apostles applied to us additional prohibitions, and those are the four commandments of Acts 15. Number three, on the basis of the great commandment to love one's neighbor, as interpreted by our master, the Gentile Christian is obligated to all the positive commandments, the one another commandments. And one final point. Because these laws don't include commandments like the Sabbath, the holy days, and so forth, that does not mean that those things are not part of your religion and practice, or part of the religion and practice of Marmari's convert in Armenia. They are still part of the biblical religion. It's just that the level of liability is different. Moreover, these laws are, you know, these laws that we've been over, that I just ran over, these are the minimum, not the maximum. These are not the laws, by the way, to keep, you know, in order to earn salvation or something like that. We're not talking legalism here. I shouldn't even need to bring that up. But just in case there's anyone thinking, oh, this is what I have to do in order to earn salvation, you know, it's another conversation. But my point is, there is nothing to prevent anyone from taking on more than these. And there is merit and there is reward in doing so. And this is what the apostles said in the Didache, where it says, for if you are able to bear the whole yoke of the Lord, you will be perfect. But if you are not, do what you are able to do. Do what you can do. And concerning food, do what you are able. But against that which is sacrificed to idols, be exceedingly on your guard, for it is the service of dead gods. And of course, we can sum them all up. Everything, all of the above, we can sum up in two words. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. The rest is commentary. Now go and study.
Take on my yoke and learn from me, and find rest for your soul.